Thanks for having me here. It's really a great pleasure. I'm really excited to share these results that I've been thinking, this project that I've been thinking about. And the topic of the talk today will really be about quantum complexity and how we can think about quantum complexity being useful to try to understand some fundamental aspects of quantum many-body systems. So the first thing is that I want to really thank my awesome team of collaborators. And that's Jonas, Teja, and Jens based in Berlin. I actually forgot to update the slide. Teja has now moved to Barcelona. And also Anthony and Nicole, who are based in Maryland. So it's been a really wonderful collaboration. And it's been a great project to work with these people. I do want to highlight two particular contributions in relation to this talk. First is Jonas, who really took the lead on the projects that I'll be mentioning in the first part of my talk, which is this growth of quantum complexity in random circuits. And I had the opportunity to supervise Teja's master's project in Berlin. And that was about the topic of the second part of my talk that's going to be on the relation between complexity and entropy. Okay, so the premise where I'd like to start from is really the Hilbert space of, you know, of n qubits or n subsystems is absolutely enormous. And, you know, if I have n qubits, then the dimension of that Hilbert space is 2 to the n, so it's exponential in the number of qubits. And typically the states that we typically encounter in physics, or, you know, the state that you might want to write down with a pen on your paper with perhaps very few parameters, they typically only occupy a tiny sliver or a tiny little piece of that humongous Hilbert space. And those are the states that we can describe kind of very easily. And the question is, how can we go by and kind of, how can we get a handle on what happens to the states that are beyond that just small patch of states that we can describe very easily and that we usually encounter in physics? So kind of those are the states of higher complexity that I'll be trying to understand in this talk. So my talk is kind of focused around two main questions. I mean, I'm gonna have a first part that's more an introductory part where I'm going to try to convey the idea that quantum complexity might be something that can be really interesting to care about in physics and to understand many-body physics. And then the bulk of my talk will be centered around two main questions. And the first one is I'll explain some results and how to show that quantum complexity in the random circuits grows linearly in time up to reaching values that are exponential in the system size. And the second part of the bulk of my talk, I'll be switching gears to a different approach and I'll be thinking about how quantum complexity manifests itself in operational aspects of what I can do to a system. So, you know, how does quantum complexity influence what useful things I can do with a system? All right, let me focus with this first introduction part. So imagine that I have a collection of n systems. I might have some many-body Hamiltonian and they might be interacting. And I'll initialize the system in a product state of all zero states. And I'll apply this many-body Hamiltonian and apply this unitary evolution to the system. And after some time, what usually happens, not always, but let's take kind of a relatively usual case where the system thermalizes. And what I mean by that is kind of, if I measure any local observable, it will look like it just reached a thermal state. And it really looks like the system no longer evolves, right? It's kind of reached some thermal state and that's kind of the end of the story. But we really know that's not the case, right? If I know that I started with a pure state, I evolved according to a Hamiltonian. So this thing is still pure, secretly it's pure. It looks thermal, but it's secretly pure. And if I continue applying my Hamiltonian onto it, it has to still be a pure state evolution, right? It's something must still be going on. And kind of the question is, can we really study what's going on past these timescales where the system has thermalized and everything seems to have reached some kind of equilibrium, even though the state is actually pure and is continuing to evolve? Now you might worry that this is something, you know, why care about this? Because this is beyond the reach of what we can, you know, if the system looks like it's no longer evolving, why care about what's going on secretly behind the scenes if we can't access it? And I will argue that actually we can access that regime because if we had, you know, if we had in principle a quantum computer, we could go and maybe reverse the evolution from there, simulate the inverse Hamiltonian and bring it back to the state that, and, you know, apply some simple operator here, and that would have the effect of probing some interesting operator that would lie in kind of this type of complexity regime here. So I think this is a regime that could be accessed in principle with sufficient technology. So I think it's something that you can't just say, oh, it's beyond the thermalization timescale, so we shouldn't care about it. So I've mentioned complexity a couple of times, so I should give you some definition, at least for you to be able to hang on to something, you know, in concrete. So when I talk about the quantum circuit complexity, or quantum complexity for short, of a unitary U that acts on n qubits, what I really mean is I'm counting the minimal number of gates of two-qubit gates that are required to implement this unitary on a quantum computer. So let's imagine that the elementary operations I can do on a quantum computer are any two-qubit unitaries. That's a bit of a simplification, but that's kind of convenient to work with. I'm going to ask how many of these gates do I need at minimum to implement the unitary U. I can also talk about the complexity of a quantum state psi. And there, the definition will be extremely similar. I am going to ask, what is the minimal number of gates that I need to prepare the state psi if I apply this circuit onto some reference product state of all zero states on my initial n qubits. All right, now quantum complexity is kind of interesting, again, from the more physical perspective, because it gives us an axis according to which we can start organizing physical phenomena and different ideas and different notions in quantum information. So for instance, as I mentioned before, thermalization is typically something that happens relatively at short complexity scales because, you know, if already at some short time, I could expect my system to have reached the thermal state, and that would correspond to few gates on an evolution that I could simulate with few gates on a quantum computer in principle. Other notions such as scrambling, topological phases of matter, or quantum error correction are also notions that happen at fairly low complexity scales. Because, you know, for instance, the topological phase is basically, you know, one can define a topological phase as being, a state would be in a topological phase if I cannot prepare it with a constant depth circuit starting from a trivial phase state. But maybe I could prepare it with a circuit of size, you know, maybe n squared gates, or, you know, a depth n circuits. That would already be in principle good, and that would still lie at this kind of at this end of this axis, because this complexity axis goes all the way to exponential values. Now, at the other edge of the complexity axis, we have reason to believe that, you know, quantum chaotic systems, or even wormholes in quantum gravity, really are systems that explore, that are in states that really explore this edge here of this complexity axis. And again, the topic of my talk will be kind of, can we address this void here in the middle? Can we see how can we develop the right tools, and how can we start understanding what's going on here in this middle part of this complexity axis? Okay, now I want to connect this question also to quantum gravity, and I imagine that in the audience there are a lot of experts on this, you know, that are way more competent than I am here. So, but I do want to connect what I'm doing to that field. So imagine that we have a black hole, and, you know, I imagine a black hole as a quirk in space-time, deformation in space-time, where if matter happens to fall in, well then, you know, it can't get back out. And, you know, from general relativity, we know that a more useful diagram to study this black hole is a diagram like this. And here, the blue line corresponds to an observer that is sitting outside the black hole, and these white arrows correspond to, again, matter that is falling inside the black hole. And this brown line here is the event horizon of the black hole. Now, as you can see on this diagram, actually there are, this diagram represents a black hole that has two sides. So it's connected to kind of two universes. And, you know, that kind of comes out of the mathematical description of the black hole. And if I look at a more concrete example in ADS-CFT, this is the same diagram as I had before, right? You know, I have the black hole with its two sides, with the two kind of universes on both sides. And the kind of important thing that ADS-CFT tells us is that everything that happens in this bulk region here, everything that happens within this diagram can be represented exactly on actually the dual space of this bulk, which is a conformal field theory, or, you know, a regular quantum field theory, if you like, that lies here on the boundaries, on the two boundaries here of this space. So in this particular case, we can imagine, you know, taking a time slice here, and this would correspond to what's what is known as a thermal field double state. It's basically some very entangled state between both sides of the black hole, between the two CFTs, right? This is a boundary description. And we can ask, what happens if I time evolve this state in the bulk? And well, we see that kind of this line starts threading through the black hole, and kind of this chunk of line, we can think of that as some kind of wormhole that connects both edges. It still doesn't mean that we can traverse from one side to the other, but it's kind of something that goes through the black hole and that kind of connects both universes together. And we can see as we evolve in time here, this wormhole gets longer and longer and it does that for a long time. And on the CFT, we know that this corresponds to time evolution simply on the CFTs in the boundary. But you know, the question is, what is the quantity on the CFT that corresponds to this wormhole length in the bulk theory? And that is where Lenny Susskind explained that, you know, probably we should be thinking of quantum complexity as being the quantity that is dual to this wormhole length here. And one of the important reasons for that is that complexity continues to grow in the CFT. The complexity of the state will continue to grow all the way until these late times here. Whereas a lot of other quantities you might want to come up with, such as entropy or other physical quantities, they will typically saturate and thermalize very quickly. Okay, so kind of more formally, that's the Brown and Susskind conjecture, that if I have a system that is suitably chaotic, say a quantum system of n qubits that evolves according to some random circuit, then we expect the complexity to grow somewhat linearly all the way until values that are exponential in the system, in the system size. And that would be kind of the maximum complexity that you can reach in such a system. Okay, so that wraps up kind of the picture I wanted to paint about why we should care about quantum complexity in many black systems. So now the first main part of my talk that I want to talk about is kind of addressing this Brown and Susskind conjecture that I just mentioned. Can we show this linear growth of complexity in random circuits? And so the first thing I am going to do, which I already mentioned, is that I mentioned that, you know, we're interested in chaotic systems in general. In general, you know, these systems are described by particles that evolve according to some Hamiltonian. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the simplified model, where I replace all of that. I forget that I have a Hamiltonian, and I replace that by a random circuit. And what that means is I start with, you know, some initial state, and then I pick gates at random, and I just apply random gates here. And I, you know, at every time step, I apply, say, a layer of gates that I've chosen completely randomly from the Haar measure on the two-qubit universe. And there's, of course, this is a bit of a drastic simplification. There are still a lot of open questions on what's the gap really in this description here. But I'll work with this assumption and, you know, consider random circuits as a model to work with right now. So if we apply random gates, if we start building up a circuit with random gates, well, it's kind of intuitive that the more gates we apply, at least at the beginning, the more gates we apply, the more and more kind of complex the circuit becomes. So it's kind of intuitive that the complexity will increase. And maybe what we could be worried about is if at some point we start adding more gates and suddenly by accident, some of these gates that we've sampled at random would kind of by accident simplify to something, you know, maybe these Abelian circuit diagram and some circuits, you know, identity, and they'd simplify to something much simpler, and maybe to a single gate. And what that would imply would be that these later gates that I sampled and added would actually not increase the complexity, would decrease it, because suddenly there's a simpler description of this whole unitary. So, you know, that might be what, that could be something we should be worried about. But the thing we want, the direction I want to go in and to show is that this basically never happens, or it happens really with vanishing probability. Okay, so that this is kind of the main thing that I'll be trying to prove and to show the proof to you right now. To give you some intuition about how this goes, I wanted to show you these images here. I don't know if you've probably played with Google Earth, and you know, you have the model of the Earth, and you can rotate it around. And even if you rotate it a couple times around the standard axes, you realize that pretty quickly you're facing in the middle of some random location in some random orientation. And intuitively, really what happens is that by applying just the two or three rotations, even along the standard axis, you kind of each time explored a new direction in the space of all possible rotations of the sphere. So really you're exploring, by just doing three rotations, you're kind of exploring the whole space of possible rotations you could do on the sphere. And that's because the group of rotations of the sphere has three dimensions. So now, the interesting thing is that, so that was the example for kind of, if we have a sphere and we rotate it, and that we had, you know, three dimensions. And now imagine that instead of having the Earth, we had, you know, some super high dimensional object that has 2 to the n dimensions. So I'm looking at unitaries over 2 to the n dimensions. So now this thing has a number of dimensions that's exponential. So the number of directions that I can go in this rotation group is now 4 to the n. It's no longer just 3, it's 4 to the n. So that means that every time that I'm applying a gate, intuitively, it's extremely unlikely that I would be exploring the same direction that I would have already been exploring at an earlier time step. So really the intuition behind this, our approach to this linear growth is really this. Every time I apply a new gate into the circuit, I'm very likely to explore a new direction in the space of all possible unitaries. And that's kind of, that eventually will start filling up the space of all possible unitaries. Okay, so I'm going to show you our main result here, the first main result that I wanted to show you. And that's that we show that if you take a random circuit consisting of a certain number of R of gates, a certain number of R of gates, then we showed that the complexity, if you sample a circuit with random gates, with a certain number R of random gates, we show that the exact complexity of this unitary, the circuit, is lower bounded by a value that is linear in the number of gates R composing the circuit. Now there are some, you don't have to worry about this term, and this L coefficient here is related to how well connected the circuit layout is. Right. So I didn't mean to really go into detail, but really the important thing is that, of course, it's not enough to just sample the gates. We also need to make sure that kind of these gates are sufficiently, locations that are sufficiently well connected. All right. Now, the idea is, I didn't want to dive too deep into the gory details of this proof, but I thought that I'd try to give you a taste about the important ingredients and the main intuition that goes into proving this theorem. So this might be a little technical, but I'll try to stay at a relatively high level here. So don't be too scared. The idea is that, imagine that we have a circuit layout. So we have a certain, what I'll call an architecture. I just fix where I'm going to place the gates. And I don't tell you what gates yet I'm going to place in there. And then I look at all possible unitaries, unitaries on the n-qubit space that I can implement with a layout of this form, right? So I ask, what is the set of all possible unitary operations that I can implement by plugging in gates in here? And technically you can describe that as the image of the map that maps kind of choices of gates to the actual gate, to the actual complete unitary that is represented by contracting these gates in this layout. So really what's important, the important object I want to focus on right now is this kind of set here. This is the set of all possible unitaries that you can achieve with a circuit of this form by plugging in different gates in these different slots. And the interesting thing about this way of thinking is that we can really open the whole toolbox of algebraic geometry, and there's a rich structure there we can exploit. And there's one particular concept that I want to focus on here is what we call the accessible dimension. And that will be the dimension of this set, right? So we have the set of all possible unitaries we can generate with an architecture, and the quantity that I'm really interested in here will be the dimension of the set. The reason I'm interested in the dimension of this set is that it's actually going to be a good proxy to understand the complexity that can be generated by circuits of the architecture A. So we show that you can show that this accessible dimension is both upper bounded and lower bounded by quantities that are basically linear in the number of gates that are in the architecture. So that means that, you know, let's think of there's a linear relationship between the accessible dimension and the number there's an at most linear relationship between the accessible dimension and the number of gates that compose the circuit of the architecture A. Now, there's some heavy lifting that comes into proving this lower bound here, I figured I would skip the details because it kind of involves manipulating circuits around. And, you know, I'm happy to come back to more details here if you're interested. And now the core idea of the proof is to say that, well, if I have a random circuit that I sampled according to some architecture, then we know that if you know, you can ask, what is the complexity of this unitary that I've sampled? And for this complexity to be significantly lower than R, it would have to be in the image of an architecture that has a strictly smaller accessible dimension, right? So, and that happens with probability zero, right? So that's the idea of the proof is really this. So if I sample a circuit from an architecture A, then for this unitary to happen to lie in the image of some lower dimensional set is zero. And you know, this lower dimensional set is the image of, you know, an architecture A prime that would have less than a linear fraction of gates than the architecture A. So really what that shows is kind of that, if I translate that back to our main theorem statement, this is what we have, right? If I sample a random circuit with respect to some architecture, then really it would be in the image of some lower dimensional architecture with probability zero. And if I translate that back to a number of gates, you know, using this linear relationship between upper bounds and lower bounds between the accessible dimension and the number of gates, we get that, you know, this complexity of the circuit that I sampled is necessarily lower bounded by something that is linear in the number of gates. Okay, I hope that was not too confusing. I'm going to step back out of the technicalities of, you know, how to prove this theorem. And I did want to make a few remarks about this theorem. First is that there are a few extensions that we can show. First, you know, that I said that the gates have to be sampled at random from the Haar measure on the 2-qubit unitaries. We actually can relax that assumption. You know, we can actually assume that the gates are sampled from any measure that has some kind of sufficiently smooth distribution across the whole space of 2-qubit unitaries. All right, we can also accommodate the situation where not only you choose the gates randomly in a fixed architecture, but maybe you choose the architecture itself randomly. So maybe, you know, the process would be, I choose 2-qubit gates at random, but I also choose at random where I'm going to apply them. And, you know, that's also a situation we can accommodate. There's one big caveat that I do want to emphasize with this result is, you know, this is all about the exact complexity. And usually that's, you know, we'd really want to have a statement that's robust against small perturbations. And I think we have some intuitive reasons to believe that kind of this statement should be robust to perturbations, but it's really hard. Our proof techniques might not be the right proof techniques to actually show that. So really our theorem is really only for the exact complexity. And we have some kind of intuition for why it should also be the case for if we allow some error tolerance. You know, maybe you'd be interested in a measure of complexity that is not only you're not asking for, you know, how many gates do I need to implement a circuit exactly, but you might ask how many gates do I need to implement the circuit approximately. And that's a situation that's more, you know, physically interesting, but it's also much harder to get a handle on. And our proof techniques are not, we haven't managed to leverage them to really get a result on that. And I do want to highlight those other results here because they also provide very significant progress towards showing results of this type. And a lot of these results actually are robust. So, you know, that's a feature that we weren't able to reduce. We have the linear growth, we have this linear factor here, but at the expense of not being robust in the too small errors. All right. Okay, so that was the part about the linear growth of quantum complexity in random circuits. Now I wanted to shift gears onto
Philippe.
Yeah.
There's a question in the chat about what L was in the previous formula.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. Yeah, I deliberately stated very vaguely that L is related to the how connected the circuit layout is. There's a definition for it. There's a requirement that the architecture, I should be able to split my, so, you know, I have my circuit layout, which I call an architecture. It's where I place the gates. I should be able to split this architecture into blocks. Each block should have at most L gates, and each block must have the property that there exists some qubits at the output of the block that I can reach from any input qubits of the block. So kind of visually by passing through gate slots, if you like. So visually, that means that I must have kinds of some kind of backwards light cone from any output qubits to there must exist one output qubit in each block that has this backward light cone that spreads across the whole inputs of that block. And that must happen, you know, for each block in the way I've split my architecture, and each block must have at most L gates. So that's where L comes in.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. I hope that answers the question. Okay. Now, let me shift gears to the second part of the, you know, the bulk of my talk, which is how can we think of complexity? How does quantum complexity fit into the picture where we want to ask, what type of operations can I do on my system? You know, if I have a system, usually you'd be interested in saying, can I do something useful with it? You know, can I build a heat engine? Can I extract work, something like that? Or can I, perform quantum computation? And now the question is, how can we fit quantum complexity into these frameworks that will tell us how useful a quantum system is for doing something, for doing something with it? And I'll be more specific in a second. Maybe another picture to represent what I have in mind is that I showed you this axis of complexity where pure states are organized according to their complexity. And Brown and Susskind, presented this idea that there should be some kind of second law of complexity where states should only be allowed to evolve towards higher degrees of complexity according to their own natural evolution in some suitable sense. And that, of course, reminds us a lot of another axis that we've already encountered, which is the entropy axis. And what I mean by that is I can organize quantum states according to how mixed they are, how much entropy they have. And now I'm really talking about all mixed quantum states, not just the pure states. And we already know, of course, that there's the second law of thermodynamics that somehow, in some suitable sense, tells us that we should expect the natural evolution of systems to tend towards states of higher entropy. And the question, kind of one of the question that I want to ask is, how do these concepts of entropy and complexity play together? Is there kind of some in the between regime here between these two axes that kind of tells us something, how entropy and complexity play together? And for that, I want to draw on some intuition that we have from the second law of thermodynamics and what we know of quantum and information thermodynamics. Okay, for that, I can say a little bit more specifically what I mean by that. You know, thermodynamics is really a theory that tells us what you can do in terms of processes, what processes you're allowed to do if you're a macroscopic observer. And, more specifically, I can ask, well, how does quantum complexity manifest itself in, if I ask how many resources do I need to carry out a certain process on a system, maybe that's thermodynamic work. Well, how does quantum complexity enter the play into, how does quantum complexity enter the equation of this, how many resources do I need to carry out that process? And now I'm going to focus on a particular process for the sake of this study here. And that's the process where I have the system in some unknown quantum state and I want to reset it into a reference pure state. And that's a process known as Landau erasure. Okay, I should probably now step back again and focus again on the concept of Landau erasure in the field of information thermodynamics. And what happens is that we imagine that we have a quantum system that is in some state, that is in some completely unknown state, and we'd like to reset it to the all zero state. Now, for simplicity, I'm going to imagine that this is, say, some memory register in a quantum computer. And I'm going to simplify the problem, and assume that the Hamiltonian of this system is actually completely degenerate. I'm not going to worry about how stable this memory is or things like that. I'm going to live in this idealized world where I can just manipulate things with high degrees of control and I can just have this degenerate memory register that I can play around with. Okay, now the important insight that Landauer and other people had was that if I want to reset this memory register to this state where I only have zeros at the output, then all of this entropy must go somewhere. It has to go to the environment, because I'm doing overall some reversible process. So all this entropy that I had here, it can't just disappear, it has to go to the environment. And what that means is that the entropy of the environment increases. And what that means is I have heat that is being dissipated. And that in turn translates to a thermodynamic work that I have to provide in order to compensate for that. So really this is usually what is meant by a statement of Landauer's principle. And you know, what is usually meant is that if I want to reset one bit from an unknown state to the pure to a pure reference state, the zero state, then I need to spend an amount of work that is at least kt log 2, you know, for each bit that I want to erase like that. Now, there are also, you know, various arguments and frameworks that say that I can actually achieve that equality in a suitable idealized setting, where indeed I can just spend an amount of work that's close to kt log 2 and reset my unknown bit, my unknown quantum bit, back to a pure zero state. Okay, so this is the process of Landauer erasure. Now, I want to dive into this erasure process a little bit more and kind of first explore one first optimization you can think of. So first, you can say, let's imagine that I don't have a completely unknown state, but let's imagine that I have some structure in the state. I'm going to assume that I know that the state is described by a density operator rho. So maybe this state has already some qubits that are already in a pure state, and maybe some other qubits are in mixed states, you know, a state with entropy, but that maybe there might even be correlations between these different bits. So what I'm going to do is I'm first going to do some form of data compression, you know, and data compression consists in taking, finding a reversible unitary that will condense, that will kind of concentrate all of this mixedness, all of this entropy that rho has, all of this information that rho has, this kind of unknown information that is entropy, you know, that it will concentrate all of that information onto few qubits in this register, on fewer qubits in this register. So I can do that with a unitary. This is a reversible process. So this, in principle, does not need any entropy to be dumped into the environment. So in principle, I can do this without any work cost. And then, you know, I don't need to erase my entire register. I already have a bunch of these qubits that are in the zero state. So maybe I can get away by resetting only these fewer qubits here. I only need to reset these using some kind of Landauer erasure process that I described on the previous slide in order to achieve complete erasure from this density operator to this state of all zero states. So I've achieved, I've reset my memory register to the all zero states at a total work cost that is kt log 2 times the number of qubits that I had to erase here. And this number of qubits is really given by how many qubits do I need to compress the state rho? And that's given typically by some kind of entropy measure, right? There's some measure of entropy. I'm going to come back to how this is defined later, but for now, it's really just the number of qubits that I need in order to compress my state rho. Okay, so this is the total amount of work that I need in general to reset a unknown state rho from, no, sorry, to reset a state, to reset a memory register that's in a state rho to the states of all zero states. Now, you might be worried that I pulled these out of a hat. You know, why should I be allowed to do this? I kind of justified that by how much entropy is going into the environment, and I waved my hands around. But really, there is a big bulk of a chunk of literature that explores all of the possible things you can do with reasonable assumptions. You can, you know, the keywords here might be, one of the keywords would be the resource theory of thermodynamics. And there really are very robust frameworks that systematically analyze what you can do with, you know, simple operations and simple assumptions for this type of framework. So kind of these, that provides a justification for why I assumed these operations should be possible. Okay, now let's try to bring complexity into the picture. Let's say I have a pure state that might be complex, but it's a pure state and I want to reset this memory register to the all zero state like before. Okay, so I just told you we can do data compression. And in this case, what that would mean is to have a unitary that maps this state psi. It's a pure state. So I can, there definitely is a unitary that will map this pure state psi to the all zero states. That would correspond to uncomputing the states, right? To applying the reverse circuits of the preparation circuit for psi. And the problem is, of course, if this state is very complex, that means that I have to apply a huge number of gates. So actually, this uncomputing at no work cost is something that might not be a good assumption, because maybe it doesn't have any work costs. I might not want to assume that I can do this for free, because it might not have any work cost, but it might have a very high complexity cost. On the other hand, there's something else I could do, right? I could ignore the fact that this is a pure state. I could just treat it as a completely unknown state, just dump everything into the environment and erase this thing bit by bit, qubit by qubit, and pay whatever work I need to do that, which is ktlog 2 per bit. And I've reset, in this case, my entire memory register to the L0 state using a work cost that is linear in N, but without any complexity cost. I didn't have to apply any complex unitaries in this case. So this points to some general trade-off between how much thermodynamic work do I need to reset a system and how much complexity, what's the complexity cost of resetting my system to the L0 states. Okay, so now we set off to answer kind of the general case. So here I started off with a pure state and I assumed it was very complex. Now, what if we have some general state rho? What if we have some general state rho that we want to reset to the L0 states and we have some constraint? We do not want to use more than a certain number R of computational gates in our quantum computer. So what, you know, how much work do we need? What are the resources that we need? So how much work do we need to invest in order to reset rho to the L0 state? So we looked at protocols of this form. So imagine that we apply a certain number of gates R, and imagine that we try to choose those gates in the best way in the best way possible, so that a certain number of these qubits at the end finish up in the zero state. And we want to find these gates. We want to find a circuit here with at most R gates that will maximize this number of qubits that are already in the zero state, such that, you know, any remaining qubits, I'll have to re-raise them by paying work. But any remaining qubits, so you know, the fewer qubits I have here, the less work I will have to expend in the end. And this is the second result that I want to point out in this talk, which is that the number of qubits that I'm left here, or the number of pure states that I can extract in this way from the state rho, is given by n, which is the total number of qubits, minus some new entropy measure that we introduce and that I'll define on the next slide. And this is some entropy measure that not only accounts for kind of how much entropy there is in the state rho, but also that accounts for this complexity of, you know, how kind of it accounts for, you know, how much entropy. It's really an entropy measure that accounts not only about the actual entropy that is in rho, but also how complex it is to extract these pure states, if you like. So, you know, this entropy measure, before we had this entropy measure, that another entropy measure that told us how many qubits do I need to compress a state rho onto, you know, onto those fewer qubits using any unitary. Now, this entropy measure is a variant of that. It's an extension that tells us how many qubits do I need to compress rho to these fewer qubits if I can only apply at most this number R of gates. All right. Now, how is this entropy defined? I wanted to kind of give you a taste of how it's defined and how it's kind of what the mathematical expression for it is. So first of all, you know, intuitively, we want to describe this complexity entropy is the amount of entropy that the state appears to have if we can only access it with observables with some limited complexity that's at least R. So the way we define it is to say that it's based on the so-called hypothesis testing entropy. In case you've already heard of that, you know, that's it's really based off of this. If you don't know about this, it doesn't matter. The complexity entropy is defined by this minimization here. I try to find some, let's think of this as a projector that I can implement with a circuit of size at most R. I'm looking for a projector that has a property that it captures all of the weights of my state rho, or at least a significant fraction of weight of my state rho. Here, eta is some success probability that I can think, you know, I can plug in maybe 1 minus epsilon or something like that. It should be close to 1. So we want to capture most of the state rho, and we want to see if there's such a projector that has a very low degree of mixedness. You know, this is the trace of this projector. I want to find such a projector that has kind of the lowest, that spans the fewest possible basis states, fewest possible kind of eigenstates, if you like. So really, we want to find a PoVM effect or a projector that has that we can implement easily with, you know, complexity at most R. It has to capture all of the weight of the state, and we want to minimize the how wide this projector has to be, basically. Okay, and that gives us this complexity entropy. And yeah. And to give you again some intuition of what this should represent, if I plot this complexity entropy as a function of this R parameter, we'd expect to see a curve something like this, right? We expect to see that maybe for values of R that are very small, maybe this entropy is very close to N, And that would mean that rho looks very mixed if I can only probe it with very simple observables. And if you know, if this curve has this property of dropping to low values for higher R's, what that would mean is that, you know, rho actually has a very low entropy in the eyes of an agent that can actually carry out those gate the circuits of size of size R of these values here. So really, kind of the message I want to drive home is that the operational meaning of this complexity entropy is it's the amount of work that I need to reset a state from state rho to the all zero state. And it's really, I can identify that intuitively by the amount of entropy that a state appears to have to an agent that can only perform circuits of size R. There are some kind of properties of this entropy measure, maybe for those of you who encountered entropy measures like this before. I didn't want to go too deep in details here, but basically there are two categories of properties. One is the kind of simple properties that we'd expect from this measure that indeed we can show that they hold. Some monotonicity statements, the fact that we recover the standard entropy measures in the limit where we allow arbitrarily complex measurements. And there's another category of properties that by design cannot hold for this entropy measure. Well, for instance, we know that the von Neumann entropy, you know, the standards entropy that we use in quantum information, that one does not change if we apply a unitary to a state. You know, that's unitarily invariant because the von Neumann entropy only depends on the spectrum of the state, only depends on, you know, the eigenvalues of your density operator. Well, in this case, you know, applying a unitary might radically change the complexity of a state. So we cannot expect this new complexity entropy measure to be unitarily invariant. Okay. Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention here is that this there's an interesting aspect of this entropy measure that might actually give us a good way of defining a new notion of complexity for mixed states. You know, there are different ways you can think about how you can define complexity for mixed states, and this one might actually give a notion of complexity for mixed states that's similar to a notion that was proposed here in Brindau et al. In this paper here in 2021, PRX quantum. Okay, so you know what can we say about this entropy? I think one interesting thing about this complexity entropy is that it can help us go towards some kind of common formulation of the second law of thermodynamics and the second law of complexity. And what I mean by that is if we could show that this entropy measure kind of always increases under some, you know, natural assumptions or, you know, under natural evolution of the quantum system, well, that would mean that we can only, well, that would mean that kind of the second, that would kind of both imply the second law of thermodynamics in the sense that entropy kind of only would increase in according to those types to the natural evolution of the system. And also that the that kind of entropy cannot, kind of purity cannot go towards lower complexity scales. And that's, you know, that would also imply some form of second law of complexity as, you know, as proposed by Brown and Sussman. Now, one thing I didn't mention is that we also can construct a resource theory of complexity. You know, resource theories are a tool that we like to play with in quantum information that tells you what you can do and not what you cannot do based on a simple set of rules. And there's an object in these resource theories that are really interesting that we often want to understand, and those are monotones. And we do expect that this complexity entropy would form a good basis to find monotones in this resource theory of complexity. All right. And now more broadly, you know, this, we use entropy everywhere in physics, from trying to describe, you know, what's the, you know, phase transitions, from describing, you know, what happens in a heat engine and so on. So I would imagine it could be one direction I'm really interested in pursuing is to understand to which extent we can augment the resolution of those statements to add kind of this complexity axis to understand, well, not only, you know, complexity, to not only understand what entropy tells us about these systems, but what entropy at a given complexity scale can tell us about these physical systems. All right, and then there are a bunch of other questions and applications that I think are really interesting to explore. First is, I already mentioned data compression. So this complexity entropy basically is a measure of data compression if you're computationally limited. And we also think it's really closely related to quantum pseudorandomness. So I'd be really interested to kind of explore this connection much more deeply and see how to which extent it's useful to quantify quantum pseudorandomness. I also mentioned before that this Landauer erasure process that I considered was an example of a process that we could look at. There are many other processes that we could think about exploring as well. You know, what would happen if I wanted to erase a system, but I also had access to an ancillary system that might contain information about my memory register. So, you know, that's what we would call a quantum memory. You know, what are the resources required to do that with computational limitations? Or what is the work cost of doing a general quantum process with computational limitations? What happens if I have a Hamiltonian that's not trivial, as I assumed? So all of these questions have already similar analogs in this standard information theory, information thermodynamics frameworks. And now kind of, I think there we have an opportunity here for doing computationally limited versions of those, answering computationally limited versions of those questions. And I also think we have here an opportunity to introduce the notion of complexity in various resource theories. And for instance, we can think of this as a way of introducing notion of complexity in the resource theory of thermodynamics. Now, there are a lot of entropy measures out there, especially when you start looking at this one-shot regime that we like to look at. And at some point, I really got lost into all of these different entropy measures that are out there, and I drew this diagram. And we can ask, where does this new complexity entropy fit in? And do we really need an extra entropy measure on top of all of these? And I would argue that actually this complexity entropy doesn't fit into this diagram per se, but really explores a new direction, because this is an entropy measure that can account for the complexity of the state. All of these other entropy measures that we have in this diagram here, they're fundamentally entropy measures. They're unitarily invariant. They don't depend on the complexity of the state in any way. Now, this is something that actually adds kind of this complexity axis that these entropy measures do not have. And that also begs the question, can we make complexity equivalents of other entropy measures in this diagram, and what do they mean, and can we relate them? And there's a bunch of questions that we can inherit from the information theory, a bunch of things that we know about these entropy measures, and we can ask equivalent questions about these entropy measures that we would be these complexity equivalents of those entropy measures. So that would also, the question would also be, can we relate these entropy measures to other ideas for approaching entropy, computationally limited entropy measures, such as coarse grain entropy or other notions of computational entropy? All right, again, I mean, there are just so many open questions, I think, that are interesting to explore. Let me highlight just a few of them. First is, I think that's one important thing that I did that I might have mentioned before is that this complexity entropy in general, we expect this to be pretty hard to compute, because basically it would mean, if you can compute this complexity entropy, it would pretty much mean that you can compute the complexity of the state. That we do expect that it's hard. So can we get a handle on this quantity by computing bounds, at least in some restricted regimes? Can we lower bound this complexity entropy in the regime of low complexity? Can we use entanglement bounds? Can we use k-designs to derive these bounds? I think there are some interesting ideas to explore there. And perhaps we can do something where we can actually compute some bounds for this quantity that might be useful. Can we make statements more specifically in ADS-CFT about what this complexity tells us? And I think there are some interesting opportunities here to take this complexity entropy and bring it back to the context of ADS-CFT and see what it tells us there. And yeah, I think there are interesting questions in thermalization, chaos, and kind of, can we resolve this axis of thermalization to different into different complexity scales, and what that can tell us about the many body systems across the thermalization scale. And then there's relation to a lot of different settings that I think is also very interesting. I think it should be related to quantum magic. Or we should be able to define a version of this entropy measure for the continuous variable systems, or a version for the Nielsen complexity that is often used in this setting of ADS-CFT. And I mean, it's not even clear to me right now what the classical version of this entropy measure should be exactly. So that, I think those are all questions that are worth looking at. And then, I think there are also applications towards quantum error correction, complexity of quantum heat engines, or quantum machine learning, and applications in those directions. So what's going on? Oh, my screen just went blank. I apologize for that. Okay, I apologize for that, but that was pretty much the end of my talk. So the basic takeaway that I wanted to make that would have been on my last slide is that so we have these different notions, physical quantities of maybe energy, temperature, entropy, and so on. And basically, I think it might be useful in the context of many-body physics to think of quantum complexity also as a physical quantity. And the intuition that it would represent is really how accessible some interesting features of the quantum states are. So anyway, yeah, thanks for your attention. And I'm really sorry that somehow my slides are bungled up.
Thank you very much for that very interesting talk. Let me start by asking if there are any questions from students. All right, Eric, I'll classify you as a student for the time being.
Thank you. I just might be older than you. You spoke about quantum computing. What about classical computing? People had some weird ideas in the past about making the perfect classical computer that doesn't produce any heat, limits of computing. Wouldn't much of the same considerations apply there as well?
So you're referring to the Landauer erasure part, right? To the computation, to this toy model where this idealized model where I can compute without any without expending work as long as my computation is reversible, right?
Yes, that. But in general, defining complexity for calculations and so on, the work you did here for quantum computing, you can also describe classical computing in terms of networks and having something invertible there. So
is
there something in that direction?
I definitely would expect something like that. Yeah, that's the direction we want to explore. It's not exactly clear. I mean, in the sense that I've been talking about state complexity a lot. Of course, the state complexity of a bit string isn't very interesting because I can always prepare a given bit string very easily by flipping a certain number of bits. But then we might be interested in the state complexity of a certain probability distribution. That I guess becomes again more interesting. And I think this is something that, I mean, my expertise is more on the quantum end, so I've been thinking about this in the quantum case, but I think, this is the point I was alluding to in my last conclusion slide here, in my open question slide, that I think really the classical case is something that that I would also be very interesting to explore. Yeah. And I think a lot of what I said should carry over to the classical case.
Okay. So there's one weird random paper that appeared many years ago. If you do computing, you allocate memory. At some point, you have to free it again. And someone described the garbage collection mechanism as a refrigerator using thermodynamics to analyze programs. And that seemed to be a weird connection between classical computing and the entropy that you defined here.
Mm. Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. No, yeah, thanks for pointing that out.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Namrata, go ahead.
Oh, hi. What happens if the complexity, as it increases through time, like on a, in a quantum chaotic system, you said that it would increase linearly. Is it possible that it could be nonlinear? And how would that affect like the way you look at complexity in these chaotic quantum systems?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me come back to, I guess, this picture here, or I guess one of these pictures here.
Oh, Philippe, could you share your screen again?
Oh, that's weird. Okay, absolutely.
When it went blank, it stopped sharing also.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
Absolutely. I'm really sorry about that. It's the first time this has happened to me. Okay, so if I go back to the slide here. So I guess the question was, I should have gone back to the theorem statement, right? The question is, what happens if here you don't, can I expect, I have this lower bound, but can I expect kind of an upper bound that, can I expect this to go maybe even quadratic or something that's faster than linear in R? Is that your question?
Yes.
So that kind of, there's a simple reason why that cannot happen. And that's really simply because the upper bound is also linear in R, simply because the complexity of this circuit that consists of a certain number R of gates will not be more than R, because you know I already have a circuit that implements this unitary exactly. So the complexity, remember, it's kind of the minimal number of gates that I need to implement the circuit. So if I have a certain number of gates R here, I know already that the complexity of the circuit cannot be more than R, because I already have a circuit that implements this with R gates. So I would have an upper bound that's also linear in R.
Okay. So what if the situation was different? Like you had mentioned the black hole in ADS-CFT. Would we assume the same kind of conditions for that too, for that system?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I think there are still a lot of things that are not known between this jump between, let's look at, you know, this many body Hamiltonian, these N systems evolving according to a many body Hamiltonian. And I said, okay, let's just simplify this model and skip over to random circuits. And there's a jump here that is not completely understood yet. And a lot of the proof techniques that we can use, I mean, of course we work with this because it's much easier to get a grip on, get a handle on, but a lot of the proof techniques we use here are not applicable here. So yeah, I think it's definitely still an open question to prove the same statements for this setting here. I think there's a general belief that the same statements should hold more or less up to, you know, adapting the setting and everything. But that's definitely still an open question that we'd like to solve.
Okay, right. Thank you.
Seung-sik,
go ahead.
Hi, thank you for the nice talk. So in the first part of your talk, if you allow, say, non-local gates, but still two-qubit gates, do you know how your result would change?
Yeah, I actually forgot to mention this. The gates do not have to be geometrically local here. They can act on any two qubits. And in generally speaking, actually, this theorem statements, let me just get back to the theorem statements, it works for any architecture, right? Let me show this slide again. I can pick any architecture here, and the theorem would apply to it, right? There's kind of a condition on how well connected the gates are. And you know, maybe that if you have non-local gates, you can kind of get the better coefficient in this linear factor, but the theorem would still apply. The only question would be kind of how this L factor here changes in your different architectures. So really these gates are allowed to act. I drew them geometrically local because it's much easier, but they could be allowed in principle to act on any two qubits that I'd like to.
So L factor is still order of one, is that just saying?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
L is still order of one?
Well, L would be order of, I guess, N squared or something like that, typically, you know. Or even n log n, I guess, if you have gates that can be non-local, I guess you can kind of get this backwards light cone. I mentioned that during the talk. I didn't explain that properly, but it's, you know, you want kind of this backwards light cone property in each block of your architecture. And I guess if you have non-local gates, you could do that with a circuit of depth log n. And that would be, I guess, something of order n log n gates in that block. So L would be something like n log n.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Tarun, did you want to ask a question?
Yeah, thank you. I have a question about complexity of. Okay, let me ask the following. Suppose you you evolve the system for, let's say, time t, then there are many, many states with complexity order t. Is it true that the if I want to go from one typical state with complexity t obtained using this, I don't know, some ensemble of circuits to another circuit with similar complexity t, so there are many, many such states. So is it true that the typical complexity relating these two states, so if I go from one state with complexity t to another state with complexity t, is also order t with some prefactor?
I can certainly
put an upper bound. I mean, I can certainly go back to the product state and then go up.
That's right. You're absolutely right. That's a great question. You know, how can we go from two states of similar complexity scales, and is it easy or hard? How easy or hard is it? I think the best we can say is something like order of 2t, basically, because you can, you can uncompute your state and then to the other state. I think there's a very nice picture by Adam Brown and Lane Susskind that kind of would argue that this is actually the best you can do in general. The picture is the following. They say that if you look at, instead of the circuit complexity like it considered, if you look at the Nielsen complexity, which is something that we think is relatively similar in the way it behaves, at least qualitatively, if you look at the Nielsen complexity, you can think of it as some very negatively curved space. And you can for simplicity think of it as some kind of very uniformly negatively curved space. And what that would mean is that if you think of the product state of all zeros in the middle, and you'd have your Poincaré disk, which is some disk with the product state of all zeros in the middle, and maybe you'd have some state of a given complexity t here, and kind of the length in this geometry would tell you the complexity would be the relative complexity between two points. If I look at kind of if I look at all the states of complexity t, that would be kind of this ring of states around of radius t here. And because of the extremely strong negative curvature, if I have another point on this ring, basically the shortest path from this one point to the other would be to basically go back to the origin, or go very close back to the origin. And I think that would be an argument in favor of saying that generically the best you can hope to do is, if you want to go from one state of complexity to another, you'd need to apply something like CP gates.
Great.
Yeah. I think that's the best answer I can give.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Thanks. That's a great question.
Okay. If there are no other questions, let's thank Philippe one more time for a terrific talk.